Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice, is a leading law scholar and public policy activist. In his new book, The Fight to Vote, Waldman takes a comprehensive look at a crucial American struggle, the drive to define and defend government based on the consent of the governed. It is a history of voting rights in the United States where Waldman traces the full story from the founders' debates to today's challenges, a wave of restrictive voting laws, partisan gerrymanders, and the flood of campaign money unleashed by Citizens United. The name of the book, The Fight to Vote, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Waldman to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. Great pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
What brought you to the subject and wanting to take this comprehensive look at why voting is such a fight for so many?
Well, I lead the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU in New York City. We're in the middle of fights over voting rights and money and politics and Citizens United every day. And it was pretty clear that the democracy we all cherish was under stresses and strains it hasn't been in a long time. There's new voting laws to restrict the right to vote in 16 states in this election year. Flood of new money coming in after Citizens United. The lowest voter turnout in the 2014 election in 72 years. And I was interested above all else in understanding and in sharing the answer to the question, why now and has it always been like this? And what it turns out is when you go back to the founding of the country all the way forward till now, all throughout our history, we've always been fighting over how to build a democracy. It's not a surprise that this question of who can vote and what it means is at the center of our politics. It's always been raw and raucous and partisan from the time of the Declaration of Independence through the Civil War, through the 1960s till now.
You point out in the book that pretty much at every step of the way, while some fought to gain a voice in the government, others were fighting just as hard to silence that voice.
Well, yeah. Even at the very beginning of the country, only white men who owned property were allowed to vote. And that was a legacy from England, but it was controversial even then. Ben Franklin led a working man's revolt in Pennsylvania to try to expand voting rights. But John Adams, who of course was our second president, sort of reflected the idea that you heard over and over again throughout history. He said it would be a really bad idea to expand the right to vote. He said women will demand the vote. Lads of 18 will demand a vote. Men who have not a farthing to their name will think themselves deserving of a voice in government. He said there will be no end of it. And he was actually right. At first, they fought to expand the right to vote to the white working class, and it was upstate New York where a lot of that happened. Martin Van Buren led the fight in New York. Mm. The vote was given to former slaves after the Civil War, but then taken away, in effect. And in the North, when there were immigrants, there was just as much controversy, but it was Irish immigrants mostly and Catholics, and there was an effort to crack down on voting there. But in the 20th century, women won the right to vote. And then in the 1960s, the greatest victory of all, really all Americans, were given the right to vote through the Voting Rights Act and other breakthroughs of that kind. And at every step of the way, people were trying to stop it, people who worried that the country was changing and that they were going to lose out.
You explore American history to put all of what we're going through currently in context and why is what's happening now. I want to parse it a little bit. So what are, when you look at a snapshot of right now, what are the biggest challenges when it comes to voting rights as we approach this presidential election?
Well, first off, there is the very core basic question of who can vote. Since the modern conservative movement, and in some areas it's been the Democrats trying to crack down on voting, and in other areas it's been the Republicans. And right now, the modern conservative movement took its cue from Paul Weyrich, who founded the Heritage Foundation and other conservative flagship groups, who said, we don't want everyone to be able to vote. And in 2011, 19 state legislatures all over the country passed new laws to make it harder to vote for the first time since the Jim Crow era. And they were all different kinds of things, from cutting back on early voting, making it much harder to register to vote, and voter ID laws. I'm actually for voter ID broadly, but these were laws very carefully crafted to require IDs that a lot of people just didn't have. And the courts blocked a lot of those, but then the United States Supreme Court, very activist, very conservative, and until the passing of Justice Scalia, it looked like more to come. The Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, so that now a lot of states quickly rushed into their law books moves to make it harder for hundreds of thousands of people to vote. So first off, we don't know how this is going to affect this election, a high turnout presidential election. But then there are nobody should be fooled into thinking that things are as bad now as they used to be. You don't have people being, you know, violently attacked for voting. But something that is potentially as bad or worse than it's been is something that dilutes the power of the vote, which is the role of big money. The same Supreme Court in Citizens United and other cases really knocked down a century's worth of campaign finance laws. So you have a concentration of political financial power like we haven't seen since the Gilded Age. In the last election, the top 100 donors gave more than the 4.75 million small donors combined. That's the kind of unequal voice that would make even the founders queasy.
I was somewhat alarmed. I've been alarmed over the last several weeks since Jeb Bush dropped out of the presidential contest, because I've heard people say that, see, he had a lot of money, $100+ million, and it didn't win him the nomination, and he did very poorly in the early nominating contests. And it's similar to when it's a cold day and people say, oh, see, there is no such thing as climate change. So what do you say about that when we see how money doesn't work, but as you point out in the book, it does overall, right?
Yeah, and you're raising an excellent point, because right now, look, you're right. Jeb Bush blew through $100 million in super PAC money. And Bernie Sanders proudly points out that he's financing his campaign with small contributions. And Donald Trump essentially is self-financing. And so you're right that people say, see, what's the problem? Well, first of all, with Jeb Bush, it is an old saying in advertising, which is you can spend as much money and do great ads, but if the dogs won't eat the dog food, there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
It may just be that this was not his year, and they could have spent $300 million or $12, and it would have changed the outcome. But broadly speaking, when you look at the totality of American politics, especially below the level of the presidential race, where a candidate like Trump can get on TV nonstop for free, the big money is dominating. It's affecting state races, local races, and the further down you go, the more significant it is. And so nobody should be fooled into thinking that the problems of the post-Citizens United world have miraculously righted themselves.
You also point out in the book that in many ways we're just starting to see the effects of Citizens United, as well as other Supreme Court cases. We don't even know the full extent of those abuses yet.
Right, and I look, Larry Lessig, the law professor, said it well.
Yes,
it's not the case that money always buys results in an election, but the chase for money definitely buys results legislatively. it affects the public officials and the politicians in a significant way. And we're early in this new era, and I have no doubt that the scandals are happening, and we just don't know what they are. The scandals very often, and the impact on people often come in ways that are familiar from the banking regulatory issues or the savings and loan collapse. They're technical matters where the impact of unequal access can be felt, maybe not today, and it can seem rather arcane, but suddenly, wham, there's $100, $200, $300 billion bailout required because of some unwise policy. And unfortunately, is the kind of thing we see. We see it with climate change legislation and all other kinds of matters like that. So I am at least as alarmed about this role of money and its impact on the vote as the new voting laws, where at least there's some record of the courts stepping in. Another area that is going to have a big impact in this election is gerrymandering. I think everybody on all sides of the political divide recognize that you've got this system now where the politicians write their own and draw their own lines for their elections. This has gone back to the beginning of the country's history. This is not new. James Madison, for example, when he was writing the Constitution with his colleagues, was very worried about exactly this. Actually gave the federal government the power to override state election laws because they were so worried about it. But it's gotten worse. It's gotten computerized, and it happens to be the case right now that the Republicans did the gerrymandering this time, but both parties do. And in all these areas, there's actually some glimmers of hope. Public reaction is strong. People are angry. You hear it in this campaign, but you see it all over the country. And in both voting and in campaign finance and in redistricting reform, there's actually tremendous movement all across the country, sort of a new reform era where things are actually happening.
You point out, you quote James Madison in the book, a warning during the Constitutional Convention, it was impossible to foresee all the abuses. And you begin this book with Thomas Jefferson writing the Declaration of Independence. So we go back to really the beginning in the struggle.
Well, and the beginning in the struggle and the beginning in the contradictions
right.
in the struggle, because as Jefferson sat in a house in Philadelphia, a city that was in the middle of a revolution, of an insurrection against tyrannical power, and he wrote the Declaration saying that government is legitimate only if it relies on the consent of the governed. And as he wrote those eloquent words, he was attended by a slave, Sally Hemings' brother, Bob, a 14-year-old. So, American history never unfolds in a straight line, but that power of that democratic ideal that Jefferson put to parchment helped spur the rise of democracy over and over and over again. When the women in Seneca Falls, again in upstate New York, first demanded the right to vote, they did it by paraphrasing Jefferson's language. The people demanding the right to vote for United States Senate and for the Voting Rights Act all go back to that sort of American ideal, which we know we never lived up to even then, but it's what we aspire to. That's one of the things that gives me hope.
So in that vein, as we wrap up, talk about some of the reforms that you outline in the book that could help move democracy in a better direction.
Look, I think this is a potential tipping point for good or ill, a sort of a democracy moment. And you see this almost every 50 years or so. You've had the biggest breakthrough on voting that could happen is if we moved in this country toward automatic universal voter registration, like they have in Canada and England and Germany and all other kinds of countries all over the world. It would add 50 million people to the rolls, and you're starting to see it happen. California passed a version of it. Oregon, it passed the legislature in New Jersey, though Governor Christie vetoed it. It would make a big difference. Campaign finance, Citizens United, is wildly unpopular. As we know, both Senator Sanders and Secretary Clinton has said that she would not appoint Supreme Court justices unless they protected the right to vote and not the right of every corporation to spend freely. But you have now moves toward creative versions of public financing that passed in the ballots in Maine and in Washington State and here in New York City, we've got a very good one. And on redistricting reform, in June, sort of a little notice decision, the Supreme Court energetically blessed states moving forward with reforms. And you've started to see states put in place nonpartisan commissions to do the redistricting. California, under Governor Schwarzenegger, Arizona, Ohio just did it a few months ago. Florida has a different redistricting reform, but one that's pretty effective. I would love to see it in New York. We have a long way to go. But there's a real upsurge, like we've seen at other times in the country's history, where ordinary people and politicians, and often partisan politicians doing it for their own reasons, realize it's time to fix a broken system. That's where I think we are, and that's why the fight to vote. John Adams said there will be no end of it, and I think he was right.
Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. The book is The Fight to Vote. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Michael Waldman, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Fight to Vote by Michael Waldman, published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.